This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, and welcome to Capehart. In his Oscar-nominated 2016 documentary, I Am Not Your Negro, filmmaker Raoul Peck turned an unfinished manuscript of James Baldwin's into a celluloid examination of capitalism, racism, colonialism, exploitation, injustice. Today, Peck is turning that same lens on the Reels family in his powerful examination of the history of land dispossession from Black owners in his new documentary, Silver Dollar Road, which was recently screened at the March on Washington Film Festival here in Washington in October. In this conversation, first recorded for Washington Post Live on October 4th, Peck talks about what appealed to him about the Reels family's fight to save their home and why the meaning of home is at the center of it.
Whether you are in New York, Chicago, or elsewhere, you always hear somebody say, I'm going back home. So what it means, home? What is the symbolic value of that home? You know, where do you come from? Can we all answer that question? So it's part of who we are, and it's important to know not only our history, but what role did we play in that history?
It is great to see you again. We did a Q&A together after a screening of I Am Not Your Negro here in Washington, Raoul, 7 years ago next month. So I want to pick up the conversation along the lines of what I said in the intro. Tell us who the Reels family is and how their story exemplifies capitalism, racism, colonialism, exploitation, and injustice.
Well, who the family is, I think the film will do a better job to show this family is and what their ordeals have been for all those years. But for me, the thematic exemplify indeed the core story of this republic. We know that this country was built on land that was stolen from the indigenous people. And we know as well that Black people were enslaved to work on that land. And the whole concept of private property, which came from the European invading this country, became the necessary tool for the expansion of capital. So we are touching right there the whole DNA of what this country is, and we are living today the result of all this, where you see not only Black farmers and poor people, white and minorities losing their field, losing their farms, not being able to benefit all the institutional program that exists, but also in the urban setting through gentrification. You are living in a city that is historically majority Black. And when you go through the streets of Washington today, you see the changes. So It's the same story that goes again and again that have basically imploded to a state where today a big chunk of the population don't have the means to sustain themselves, to build any wealth, and to pass that wealth down.
Now, you learned about the Reels story from a story that ProPublica did about them, and it reported Black Americans lost 90% of their farmland between 1910 and 1997. We have a clip from Silver Dollar Road that explains how the Reels family was affected by this. Let's take a look.
Elijah Reels was my great-great-grandfather. He farmed the property, had a family upon the property, and unfortunately, in 1939, he lost the property due to back taxes. His son, Mitchell Reels, then purchased the property in 1944 at the courthouse doors due to back taxes. Unfortunately, in 1970, Mitchell died without a living will, and the property then became the heirs of Mitchell Wills. And that's when all our legal problems started. Heirs property is property that has been left to an onslaught of family members. So there was a document that was conveyed that my grandmother and her siblings did in fact own the 65 acres after a court proceeding. So it was ruled that the 65 acres did belong to the Mitchell Wills heirs.
So Raul, what are heirs property laws and how do they affect Black landowners?
Well, heirs property laws are basically a non-written law that enable people, you know, when they when a parent died and on land, instead of writing a will, they would just say, okay, the whole family will inherit the property. But in fact, that fragilizes the property instead of, you know, because mostly Black Americans did not trust the law, you know. After slavery and emancipation, there is no way most family would trust the justice system. So they thought that by not having a will and letting the property go into what is called heirs property, that means it will belong to all the descendants, it creates over multiple generations, it creates problems because there are other laws that exist that enable anybody to find someone that has never lived on the property, but who has some connection to the family to basically ask for its part of the property. And then usually, depending on the place, it's either, they separate and sell the whole property in auction, not at a market price, by the way, most of the time. And the family lose the property, you know, because they are not able to buy most of it.
Now, maybe I missed it in the reading. I was having a hard time understanding how is it that someone meaning a family like the Reels family, can not only own a property, but live on it for generations, and yet someone else can buy the property out from under them.
Yes, because it's a world in itself, especially in smaller community, in counties, where the whole power system basically have ruled for generation. You know, the lawyers, the mayors, the real estate people, and it suffices that one family in the film, it's an individual called Shedrick who basically came from New Jersey with a will that still today is controversial, despite that the fact that the grandmother had her papers, you know, saying that she's the administrator, she's the owner of the property. But the justice system did allow the misunderstanding that came out of it, and Shedrick, in his turn, sold it to promoters, so it became a society that owns the property, so that you have another level of complication. So it happened all the time because the system itself allows for that, and there is also corruption. There are also laws, local laws that enable if a family don't pay. Let's say you have a property divided into 10 different families. And one family didn't pay their taxes for some reason, either because the taxes became more than they can afford. And then you have to auction the whole property. And right there, you have another instance where people who have more money can buy the whole land. And the families have to leave. So it's a whole staple of different laws and system and power structure that basically is a mess. And there are many organizations working on that, thanks God, today, trying to, clear the titles, trying to educate families that they need to write a will Otherwise, their descendants going to have a hard time to keep the property. Mm-hmm. And I know many African-American and sometimes white citizens have a similar story in their life, whether it's the previous generation or even further back. It's, mm-hmm. it's really a big problem. And because we are in Washington, I hope that the next 2023 Farm Bill will continue the program and even expand them to allow those organizations to further educate and help funding as well families that wants to, you know, keep their property and build some sort of wealth.
Let me read something that you said about Black landowners like the Reels family. You said, you know, that these Black landowners built on that land, accepting to be on the margin. The former enslaved could only buy land that had zero value, and they made it productive. Why do you describe the history of land dispossession from Black owners as an identity issue instead of a land issue?
Well, it was never a land issue. And even in the history of Europe, you know, land was always the key. It was not only wealth, it was also a commodity. As soon as land become a commodity, that means it's something you can sell, you can buy, you can transform. And when the European invaded America, they came with that context, that concept as well. And the founding father as well continued that tradition. You know, I remind you that most the founding father were all in some way real estate men. And all the additional laws always went into that confirming, you know, private property, whereas the indigenous people never said that that land was belonged to them. They always said, we are the guarantor of those lands. We are taking care of this land, but they don't, that land doesn't belong to us. And that's the European concept is ingrained, you know, in the DNA of this country. And don't forget, after slavery, the same thing arrived. There were laws that enabled, you know, like the Homestead 1860 law, that 62 Laws Act, that enables mostly white citizen to acquire land, or to, you know, you could go to 160 acres of land, because they knew that's the fundament of any existence, of your identity, of the capacity to accumulate wealth. And of course, from there, Black people, because they were not accepted as citizen, basically, the law did not allow them to acquire those lands. So what was left for most Black farmers was to buy cheap land, swamps, basically, which would become a few decades later very important, valuable land, because first of all, they worked on that land, they made it becoming something of value. They invest in it, they grow their family on that land, like you, the Reels family. They didn't need anybody. They could fish, they could hunt, they built their house on the property. They didn't need anybody's help. They didn't beg for money. They had their own place. And so when that happened in the South, like where, as you say, the numbers are incredible, like, you know, most, I think the numbers are more than 14% of farmland were Black farmland. And starting the century, 1900, 1920, violence started, because now the white population wanted that land, mm-hmm. because it was valuable. And that's the thing. People are always talking about the Black exodus toward the North, as if it was just an incident. It started because of land, because people wanted that piece of land.
Raul, let's talk about the storytelling in Silver Dollar Road. Why did you choose to tell the story from Mamie and Kim's perspectives instead of Lee Curtis and Melvin's? Because yes. like Curtis and Melvin are the two who spent 8 years in jail for not leaving the property.
Yes. Well, that was an artistic and political choice I made very early on. Lizzie Presser article and research were key to that as well, because she did her homework. She did what I didn't want to do, which was also to inquire about what I call the other side, you know, the promoters, the people owning that portion of land, the mayors, the scholars. She really interviewed everybody. So it was through that archive that I had, that research, that I thought I need to concentrate on a film that will tell that story and through the Reels family themselves. And very early on, the two women, Kim and Mammy, were such incredible characters and storytellers. And they were the one really doing most of the job and keeping the family together, making sure that they get a lawyer, making sure that the papers are in order. And I couldn't pass that, you know. And I my decision was, that's their story, and they need to tell them themselves. So I did. I took that decision very early on. And as you can see, you know, they are incredible. They are funny. They are powerful. They tell their own story. So the part of the question about the two brothers, like Curtis and Melvin, it's because I didn't want to make it a victim story or a crime story, because it's larger than that. I wanted to establish the family as a human family, as a family that could be yours, mine, and find the time to have empathy for them, and also not to go in the normal structural U.S. documentary where we tend to contain a story and make it very personal, and then we can empathize with it, but then after the film is finished, we can go home and, okay, that was a beautiful story. I really try hard not to get in that trap and make sure that I introduce you to a family. You learn to know who they are, and hopefully you learn to love them as I do. And then come the drama of this land that they are losing. But, you know, their life is not going to stop. They are continuing their life. They, you know, the whole family, they have a life beyond that. And the fight is just part of that life. And so I didn't want to end the film into a happy end. There is no happy end so far I can see. It's the fight continue for them, you know. And I wanted to make sure that their life is told by them and see as something that is a continuum.
Escape to Ocean City, Maryland, and discover a place that just feels lighter, where every day feels like Saturday, and French fries are a food group, where flip-flops are always in fashion, and seafood is always in season, where the boardwalk is bustling, and the beach is right outside your door, where you can rise with the tide and feel like a kid again. Ocean City, Maryland, somewhere to smile about. Book your trip at OCOcean.com.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
And, you know, you mentioned the name Lizzie Presler, and she is the reporter from ProPublica who wrote the initial story that is the foundation of Silver Dollar Road. And in a sort of a post story interview that you did with her, picking up what you were just saying, you say, if you don't understand the price, the real toll on the whole family, if you can't identify with the people, you will just have pity. But I want you to have a connection, and I want the anger to be your anger about the injustice, so it's felt as an injustice to you too. One thing we didn't talk about in terms of, you know, all the legal machinations is how lawyers treated the family in all of this, whether it was attorneys overcharging them and leaving the case altogether, or paralegals and clerks forgetting who they were when they just saw them the week before. What did that behavior show you?
Well, it's those are behavior that people might know in smaller community where everybody knows everybody, and even lawyers that were defending the family, at some point they were put into pressure because powerful people said, you know, this family is not obeying our laws. They are becoming a pain in the neck, and you cannot defend them. And when you leave, you make your bread in a small community, you know, you said, okay, I have to leave the case. You know, that's all sort of pressure, the same way Melvin Boats was attacked and bombed. You know, nobody knows to this day who did that. So it's a very, close-knit community. And as long as the story stays in that small community, you know, a lot of things can happen because people are a bit defenseless face to that. And so I hope, and that's the hope of the family as well, to make this story bigger to a wider audience that will protect them a bit as well. You know, because that those two men spent 8 years in prison, and you have to know, when they went into prison, they didn't know if they were going to be there for 30 days, 90 days, but maybe a year. But that would never occur to them. But imagine they did 8 years, almost 8 years, without knowing the end of it. They could have been there indefinitely.
In my reading up on this, I think it was Melvin. Neither one expected the outcome in the courtroom that day that they were going to jail. And I think it was Melvin who even went to the courthouse, didn't even lock his doors because he figured he would be back later that day. I want to talk about your Raul, your personal connection you may have felt with the Reels family, because in an interview with Vanity Fair, last month, you said this could have been Haiti, it could have been Congo, any of those places where I've gone and met the family, the uncles, the nieces, the aunties, grandmother, the parties, the barbecue. I've lived through that with many different families, so I didn't feel that I was not at home. What did it mean to you to be with these people who are of no relation to you, but feel like that they are of relation to you?
Well, first of all, because they were welcoming, you know. When I met them the first time, it was grandmother Gertrude, 95th birthday. So family member came from all over the United States. So it was a big moment for everybody. And I was introduced there through Lizzie, who, she had been there like almost 3 years back and forth with the family. And I saw how they adopted her, you know, a white, urban, young journalist. And I watched them behaving with Lizzie, how they welcome her. And I felt she was the daughter of the family. And all that, you know, it's despite the trauma, despite the problems, the type of human relationship I felt there, I really, I'm not ashamed to say, I fell in love with them. And I felt the warmth of that community, and they made everything possible to make my life with them, making this film really agreeable. And I understood when the film was finished what it meant. Also, when I screened the film for them, a small group, the close family, we went to Raleigh to make make the screening for them. And we were having lunch after that, and Mamie said something that really warmed my heart, because she said, now a big weight is not anymore on my shoulder, because now somebody else is telling the story. And I understood what this came from, because you know, that they open their hearts, they open all the, you know, those moments in the film that are very intimate. You know, you have to trust somebody to let a camera come to your home like this.
Right,
and,
exactly.
And we, of course, had to be very discreet. We make sure that they were at ease, but it's a common production, I would say. You know, it was really a family project.
Mm-hmm. You know, I've got two big questions and about a little more than 5 minutes, and I'm going to squeeze them in. In the documentary, I Am Not Your Negro, you feature this timeless quote from James Baldwin, who said, "White people are astounded by Birmingham. Black people aren't. White people are endlessly demanding to be reassured that Birmingham is really on Mars. They don't want to believe, still less to act on that, on the belief that what is happening in Birmingham is happening all over the country." In North Carolina, the Reels family continues to this day to fight for their land. As you reflect on them, what do you want viewers to take away from their story and how it fits into this country's history?
Yeah, well, for me is, and I've said that to some of the audience in the discussions, that I hope the film will help you also interrogate who you are, because we all come from one land, one piece of land. You know, you just need to go back a few generations back. So, and understand that is your identity as well. You know, whether you are in New York, Chicago, or elsewhere, you always hear somebody say, "I'm going back home." So what it means, home? What is the symbolic value of that home? You know, where do you come from? Can we all answer that question? So it's part of who we are, and it's important to know not only our history, but what role did we play in that history? You know, whether we are Black, whether we are Indigenous, whether we are white, you know, are we just blind citizens? Do we just make, you know, say that it was always like this and it will continue? No, it was not always like this. You know, that land has a history, and each citizen, if you want to earn the denomination citizen, you need to be interested in that history.
You know, Raul, for the uninitiated who might not know your entire history, you are a former Haiti Minister of Culture back in 96 and 97. Yeah. And I bring that up because on October 2nd, the UN Security Council authorized the deployment of a Kenya-led security mission to Haiti to help police the police there fight armed gangs. As a former Haitian minister, what are your thoughts on this decision and the future of the
country? I'm enraged by this decision, and all the stakeholder knows exactly what's going on, except everybody's scared to take the responsibility of what they did. Having, you know, all my life, I've knew of interference from the Europeans and from the United States in Haitian affair. They disregard the 4 years effort of the civil society to bring up a solution that would be legal, that would be help the whole population to go back to vote. And all that have been pushed back, even though President Biden accepted the notion of a Haitian-led solution. But in the background, they have done everything to ignore this civil society that say no to the continuum of illegality of a prime minister that was never elected, but who is still being supported by both the American embassy and the European Council. So it's what do they think gonna happen? They think the Haitian gonna accept what we called in Haiti an intervention, even if it's hidden behind Kenya, another country with lots of problems. The human rights record of the Kenyan police is so bad. And everybody does as if it's normal. You know, why did Canada did not lead that mission? Why did the United States did not lead that mission? Because they know how it doesn't make sense. And they know that it's going to create even more problems.
Well, Raul, I just want to point one thing out. The UN resolution that authorized this, according to reporting in the Washington Post, was written by the United States and Ecuador. That doesn't give you any confidence.
A very powerful country. So we know who was holding the pen. So, and by the way, the US is giving $100 million to that mission. Why are they the one to pay? So we would need at least 5 hours to talk about that. But the bottom line, when a former Biden envoy to Haiti after the assassination of the president, Mr. Daniel Foote, resigned after 3 months, and basically I recommend everybody to read his resignation letter. Basically, he says our whole policy toward Haiti have been wrong. We still have the obris that we, the United States, need to decide who is going to be the next president in Haiti. And that's unfortunately the whole history of the relationship between US and Haiti, starting with supporting dictatorship in Haiti, up to today, where the only policy that seems to make sense to the administration is to send back refugees. You know, that prime minister today is there because he accepts to take back refugees the same time the American embassy is telling all Americans in Haiti to leave the country. But every day there are still loads of airplanes bringing back refugees to a torn and country where Haitians are hiding at home. The capital is invaded by 80% of the capital is in the hand of gangs. So the solution, if you think you're going to send boots without negotiating with the civil society, we know all what it's going to be. That's why the UN, it's not even a UN mission, because everybody's scared of that. They know exactly it's another Mogadishu, you know?
And Raul, as you said, we would need another 5 hours to have this part of the conversation, and we don't have 5 hours. But we're going to have to leave it there.
And Raul, thank you for having asked me about Haiti, because it's important to my heart. I work every day with the civil society there, and it's a shame what's happening. And I hope actually the Washington Post could do a better job of reporting on Haiti.
We will take that advice. Raul Peck, director of Silver Dollar Road. Great to see you again. Thank you very much for coming to KPART on Washington Post Live.
Thank you for your invitation.
Thanks for listening to KPART. It's edited by Nick Roberts. We'll have new episodes for you every Thursday. I'm Jonathan KPART. You can find me on Twitter at KPARTJ.
NetCredit is here to say yes, because you're more than a credit score. Apply in minutes and get a decision as soon as the same day. Loans offered by NetCredit or lending partner banks and serviced by NetCredit. Application subject to review and approval. Learn more at netcredit.com/partners. NetCredit. Credit to the people.